Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Dr. Juan Cole, who is considered one of our leading scholars on contemporary Iraq. We'll be talking about the insurgency and the uprisings in and around Najaf and try and explore this disconnect between the notion that this war in Iraq was lost many, many months ago, yet the American public are blissfully unaware of the extent of the disaster that George W. Bush has put this country in. And you would think in an election year that the political opposition, the Democratic nominee, John Kerry, would be able to point this out to the American people. And we'll try and understand why the one issue that could perhaps propel Kerry into the White House is not being touched. And we'll also talk about President Bush's appointment of Porter Goss to head up the Central Intelligence Agency. We'll talk with two former CIA officers and try and understand why such a clearly inflammatory choice, a poke in the eye, was taken late in the day, whether or not a vote will be taken. And obviously, if John Kerry is elected, the first thing he would do would be fire Porter Goss. And then we'll talk with Ian Williams, who's the UN correspondent for The Nation magazine, or diplomatic correspondent. And we'll be talking to him about the Veterans Wars, which is the ongoing television battle where the group calling themselves Swift Boat Veterans for the Truth are trying to defame and undo John Kerry's Vietnam record. And we'll look at this, especially in the light of what we know about George W. Bush's military record. Williams is the author of a new book, Deserter, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. So it gives you an idea of where he's coming from. I'm now speaking with Dr. Juan Cole, who is a Middle East expert based at the University of Michigan, and he's one of our leading scholars on contemporary Iraq, professor of modern Middle Eastern study and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. Let me begin with the broader assertion, which I made in the opening. It seems to me so obvious, it's been this obvious for some time, that this war in Iraq was lost perhaps within a week of the glorious victory on April the 9th, where the statue of Saddam came down, and followed on May the 1st by President Bush's photo opportunity on the aircraft carrier proclaiming mission accomplished. Why do you think there is this disconnect between the fact that there's no way out of this quagmire, it's just getting worse, and yet the American public seem blithely unaware, and in an election year you would have thought the political opposition who want to get into the White House would be able to make hay out of the fact that we have essentially Vietnam at warp speed?
Well, I have to say that I'm not an expert on American politics, and that I'm often puzzled by the way it works and turns out. It appears to me that even if one were an expert on it, it might be sometimes puzzling. With regard to Iraq, which I think I do know something about, I'd say that American goals in Iraq were in many ways contradictory, and of course those of the Bush administration war planners, Donald Rumsfeld, his deputy Paul Wolfowitz, and Douglas Feith, and others in the Bush administration simply didn't know very much about Iraqi society. And the two goals were to overthrow the Saddam regime, or three goals: overthrow the Saddam regime, establish a regime in Iraq that would be pro-American, and establish democracy in Iraq. And those three things don't necessarily go together. If you had genuine democracy in Iraq, it seems clear that Sunni and Shiite Muslim fundamentalists would dominate the parliament and elect the prime minister, and would not adopt policies that are pro-American or pro-Israeli in any way. So if what you wanted was democracy in Iraq, then you probably could get that, but it wouldn't necessarily be a pro-American democracy. If what you wanted was a pro-American regime, then you really needed a soft dictatorship something like the Mubarak regime in Egypt. But the United States didn't settle on either model. It seems to still want both goals, and I don't think they're attainable.
Well, let's just put democracy aside for a moment, Juan Cole, and just talk about stability, because that's clearly what the United States has not brought. And you would think, and in fact it seems to me to be the core of why this thing is going to hell in a handbasket. And, you know, within a few days of the victory of 9th of April, it seems to be clear to me that the Iraqi people are always hedging their bets. They've been traumatized for, 30 years of one of the most brutal dictatorships. They've essentially been lobotomized by fear. And they're looking around to find out whether the new tough guy in town, the Americans, are going to win this thing. And that the bad guys aren't going to come back, and that they were never, ever given that assurance, because we let the streets be taken over by thugs within days, and the looting took place. And it seems to me inconceivable that the United States could not have established, I mean, why go to the trouble of winning a war when you lose the peace within days?
Well, that's certainly the case that they lost the peace. Why exactly they lost it, and whether they should have expected to do so, or more controversial. I myself am a social historian, so I think that these developments are the result of broad social forces. And my analysis of it would be this, that what the Saddam regime was a minority government. It was a cobbled together constituency of the Sunni Arabs and then some secular Shiites in the center part of the country. And the only way that you could make that work, and you could get about 50% of the population behind you with such a program, the only way that you could make that work would be to marginalize the Kurds and the Shiites in the south very heavily.
And these happen to be the two areas where the oil is.
Those are the areas where the oil is. So yeah. You have to continue to control them, but what you have to do is to make the people in them completely disenfranchised, beaten down, and excluded from any kind of political power whatsoever. So in that way, I believe that pre-war Iraq, Saddam's Iraq, was very much like apartheid South Africa. It was a minority regime that stayed in power through methods of brutality and by defining people who weren't part of the regime as non-entities, and using great force and coercion to remain in power. So what the United States did was to remove that minority regime, which had two effects. One is that the majority then wanted to assert its power, the Shiites of the South, having this repression removed, allowed them to mobilize and form political parties and proselytize for them all throughout the country, and which is, they've been doing assiduously for the past year, as well as form paramilitary attachments to those parties, which was always necessary in Iraq. If you're going to have political power, it partly comes out of the barrel of a gun. And on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the minority, the Sunni Arabs, who had been dominant, perceived that the game was over, that they were going, that things were going to be reversed, and that they were going to lose everything. They were going to be dominated by this combination of Shiite ayatollahs and Kurdish warlords, and this was not an appealing fate for them. So they organized to fight against it, and they were the people with monetary resources, education, military training, such that they could mount an effective insurgency.
And awash with weapons.
I'm sorry?
And awash
with weapons. Well, I mean, Iraqis, being from many of them from a rural tribal background, had guns for hunting and things, and so the place is heavily armed. But then there were 80 huge weapons depots in the country, which I think Saddam probably deliberately ordered them to stop being guarded, and of course the army dissolved anyway. And then the United States did not capture and control those arms depots. I'm not sure all of the arms depots are still guarded at this moment. I think there are some still being looted. So, yeah, there's a lot of weaponry in the country, but also a lot of training. They make do with sometimes very little, and in a guerrilla effort, which is what they've mounted, even a little bit of munitions can go a long way.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Dr. Juan Cole, who's one of our leading scholars on contemporary Iraq. He's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. And we're talking about the insurgency and the extent to which the United States has long ago lost this war, and yet somehow it has not resonated in the press and the public, and particularly with the political opposition in terms of John Kerry's campaign, where he's actually endorsed the war in suggesting that in spite of the evidence subsequently that there was no weapons of mass destruction, he still would have taken the same boat. Obviously, he's doesn't want to go down the path of George McGovern and others who have gone out against a war while the war was in progress and opened themselves up to charges of being disloyal. But nevertheless, one would hope that our leaders were able to see ahead a little bit and recognize the folly of the actions on the part of George Bush, where, you know, since I was able to interview a few people before that war, all of whom who knew about Iraq and spoke Arabic, all of whom said it would be a disaster. You'd think that would be a minimal to expect from leaders to be able to have a little bit of foresight. But that notwithstanding, let's just touch on, again, the Sunni in the middle. Little wonder they're fighting us, because they see the writing on the wall that we're going to empower the Kurds in the north who have the oil, and the Shia in the south who have the oil, and they've brutally dominated that country, and they've just got a dry hole there in the center. And little wonder they and their Saudi Sunni brethren, the Wahhabis, are coming in to try and help them. But let's touch on the other insurgency, which is in Najaf, led by Muqtada Sadr, the somewhat demented young cleric, who I understand is basically a surrogate of the Revolutionary Guards in Iran.
Let me just lay out my perspective on Muqtada Sadr.
Right.
First of all, I don't think he's demented. I think he's ruthless. And
well, I interviewed a fellow, Jabbar, who's met him and who had a couple of audiences with him. And of course, fellow Jabbar was a close friend of Ayatollah Khoi, who was murdered a couple of days after in the early part of the occupation. So perhaps he's biased. But he said that the guys had psychiatric treatment, and you seem to see it on his face that he doesn't look like a healthy man, but maybe I'm reading something that's not there.
Well, I saw an interview with him on Al Jazeera yesterday, and here's somebody who's besieged in Najaf, and he seemed to be perfectly in control and made logical arguments. And I don't deny that he no doubt has personal problems of various sorts. Here's somebody who was in his early 20s, when people brought home his father and two older brothers riddled with bullets, having been assassinated by Saddam Hussein. And you can imagine, and of course, who lived as a young person under all of that repression and persecution launched by the Fedayi Saddam, battened on the Shia community like almost like vampires, spied on them, took them away in the middle of the night, and so forth. So here's somebody who's grown up under, let us say, very difficult conditions, and it would be impossible for someone not to be traumatized by all that. I mean, I think he in response, has developed a personality that's authoritarian. He revels in having these militias and imposing his puritanical view of society on people. He has his people firebomb video stores and liquor stores. He has women harassed if they're not all covered up. He clearly has dictatorial tendencies. I would agree with the characterization of him as an authoritarian, as a thug, and so forth.
Well, what about the notion that he's being run by the Iranian?
I don't accept that at all. Uh-huh. But I think the Iranians are scared of him. I think they think he's a loose cannon. He went to Iran last June, June of 2003, and met with Rafsanjani and some of the other high Iranian officials, and they told him to stop rocking the boat and to make a united front with Sistani, the Grand Ayatollah.
Who is in London having medical treatment.
Yes, who's in London having medical treatment. So.
And he has real respect. I mean, amongst the Shia, whereas Sa'adat doesn't seem to have a lot of respect.
Well, in the Shiite system, respect is of different sorts. Sistani's got the kind of respect, perhaps you could say, that Catholics give the Pope. You know, if the Pope issues an encyclical, the pious Catholics at least would take it very seriously, and it would be a matter of conscience and so forth. You know, Muqtada Sadr combines religion and politics and sectarian motifs, and so he has a kind of authority and a kind of appeal that's different from that what Sistani has, and both can coexist. This is the thing to keep in mind. For instance, an American CPA poll, Coalition Provisional Authority poll, done in Iraq in May. Showed favorability ratings of various Iraqi political and religious figures. Sistani's was in the high 70s, but Muqtada Sadr at that time was 68%. So there are a lot of people in Iraq who think well of both and don't see a contradiction between the two.
Well, what about it's some of this activity that's going on now with the Mahdi army and the Sa'adat City uprisings, as well as the Najaf uprisings. Seems to me that given that these guys have, the U.S. military have just been killing these guys wholesale, it reminds me of the Ayatollah Khomeini sending these young Iranian boys off in droves, many unarmed, with a little plastic key around their neck, going taking on a one-way ticket to heaven.
Well, it's pretty desperate to send these Shiite youth gangs against Marines. Obviously, they'll be mown down. Although I've seen reports in which the Marines express a certain amount of respect for how much these guys do with so little, and of course they're very brave. But you know, what I would say is the Mahdi army that Muqtada Sadr formed really should be thought of as ghetto Shiite youth gangs. These are young guys armed with rocket-propelled grenades, machine guns, sometimes mortars, no heavy munitions. Their main function is to patrol neighborhoods. They're a kind of neighborhood militia. They enforce their vision of law and order locally, and they hold turf. They fight off other militias and so forth. So, I mean, to some extent, they're kind of like the Crips and the Bloods there in Los Angeles. They're rooted in a particular community, and they're armed, and they engage in these turf battles, and they're now engaged in a turf battle with the Marines. And, of course, the Marines can defeat them militarily in any particular engagement, but it's awfully difficult to defeat them all together because of their rootedness in these ghetto communities, and many of those communities had been settled by clans from the countryside, and they stayed together when they settled a neighborhood. So they're cousins there in that neighborhood, and if two or three of the cousins get interested and they join the Mahdi army and they fight the American troops and get killed, that incurs a clan feud between the Americans and that clan, and their other cousins will then join up and replace them. So the American military has been just amazed that they thought they had inflicted substantial attrition on the movement last April and May, but now they're all these guys back, and they can't understand where they came from.
Well, just closing, Dr. Weinkolb, what is Muqtada Sadr's endgame here? Is he just using his followers as cannon fodder in order to score political points and leverage his way into power, or does he believe that he could spark an uprising and which would eventually drive the Americans out, given that they've already got their hands full in the Sunni triangle?
Yeah, it's the latter. I believe that all along Muqtada's goal has been to mobilize the Iraqi public to throw the Americans out through massive demonstrations and guerrilla actions. And last April and May, he was a lonely voice. Not very many people would pay attention to him. By now, because I think largely of missteps by the Americans and bombing Najaf is, you know, symbolically a terrible thing and will mobilize many, many Shiites all over the world against the United States. I think Muqtada is now in a position where he thinks that it's becoming plausible that he can get the rest of the Iraqis so against the United States that they will throw them out. And once that's done, of course, he does want a Shiite-dominated Iraq in which he would play a leading role and in which there, you know, he very much admires the kind of regime that is in Iran, although he wants an indigenous Iraqi situation, not Iranian dominance.
Well, just a quick final question, though. What do you think the chances are of a general uprising? I mean, given that we both agree that this war was lost within weeks of the April 9th victory, and that somehow the American people are in the dark about the true nature of what's happening there. The supplies aren't getting through. The oil's not being pumped. The uprising seems to be general. Our soldiers don't want to go out and get shot. Their officers don't want to get shot. Nobody likes the mission. They know it's political. Nobody likes these carpet-bagging contractors in here. They're the only ones who are making any who are going to win this war in terms of making money. So I don't see any hope here of anything resembling a victory, but still, what's going to break this cocoon? When is this general uprising going to take place so that the American press are going to have to start reporting the reality, and perhaps this again would be the only thing that could propel Kerry into the White House?
Well, I think it takes time to get an insurgency going, and it's been a relatively short period that people have been able to organize since the fall of Saddam. It seems to me that if the shrine of Imam Ali in Najaf is invaded, you know, that's for Muslims kind of like the Basilica of St. Peter in Rome. If it's invaded, even by Iraqi forces on behalf of the Americans, if substantial damage is done to it and so forth, I think that will certainly tip the Shiites in the south into at least a low-intensity guerrilla war against the United States for some time to come. I think the worst-case scenario for the Americans is Iran 1978, when you had hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions, coming out into the streets of the major Iranian cities, often enough so that it made the country ungovernable and the Shah and the Americans just had to leave. That could happen in Iraq, it seems to me, and I would say I'd give it a 50-50 chance of happening sometime in the next 2 years.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Warren Cole.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Dr. Warren Cole, who is a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. I'm now speaking with Mel Goodman and David McMichael, both of whom are former CIA officers, and David McMichael's a former analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency, and he's a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And Mel Goodman is a former CIA analyst and is a senior fellow for intelligence reform at the Center for International Policy. Just beginning with you, Mel, it seems to me that the President Bush's nomination of Porter Goss, given that back in, I think it was June or July, Porter Goss went on the floor of the House and condemned John Kerry, particularly about Kerry's suggestions that the intelligence services were awash with money, but not necessarily with any focus. He is such a clearly partisan choice. Is this President Bush just poking the Democrats in the eye?
I think it's a case of that, and it's a very politically effective stick because he knows darn well that the Democrats can't really criticize this nomination publicly, let alone block it in the Senate hearings for confirmation, because then they would be equated with others who've tried to get in the way of American national security. Remember what happened to Senator Max Cleland in his 2002 re-election campaign in Georgia when it was unconscionable the way he was identified with Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein just because he had legitimate criticism of the Department of Homeland Security. But that's not the greatest reason for opposing Porter Goss. The greatest reason for opposing Porter Goss is that he's been chairman of the House Intelligence Committee for 6 years. During that 6-year period, you've had the two worst CIA intelligence failures And Portergos has done nothing from his very important position as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. That is, he could not have prevented these mistakes, but he could have investigated them. He could have issued some demand for change. He could have had his own reform program as the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and he certainly should have been interested in accountability. And like the president himself, Portergos has never been interested in change, in reform, in accountability. So, therefore, this is an extremely weak and partisan nomination at a time that the country is really reeling over the failure of the CIA in the run-up to war in Iraq, when the CIA committed the worst sin it could commit to give false intelligence to a president to justify the president's desire to invade Iraq, which has been completely against the interests of the American people and has caused incredible international instability. So this whole situation just continues to unravel, continues to be out of control, and I wish the Kerry campaign could find more effective ways to exploit these obvious political disasters that the Bush administration appears to be taking us into.
Well, unfortunately, George W. Bush's mistake has become our problem. David McMichael, if Portergos is confirmed, and it's not entirely clear that when the hearings are going to be scheduled and whether they will be completed before the election, but nevertheless, wouldn't the first thing that John Kerry would do if he's elected would be to fire Portergos?
Well, the answer to that question is very much yes. I mean, as Mel and we have done this duet before, sung this. Mel gives the melody and the line, and I say doo-wop, doo-wop, as he does it, because it's we're in total agreement here. But yes, one of the peculiarities of this appointment at this time is that if in fact Mr. Bush does not win re-election, Portergos will have probably the shortest tenure in history, because he'll be gone as soon as the new president is sworn in. So that's peculiar. The one advantage about this for the Democrats, if you will, is that there will be hearings, obviously, and the Democrats need not prove obstructionist. But what they will have to do is probe the nominee as to what his ideas, what his programs are in response to the 9/11 Commission, in response to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report of recent date. And that will tend to pin him down and raise issues which arguably could be of some utility to the Democrats during the rest of the campaign.
Well, Mel Goodman, even if his Goss's tenure is measured in weeks, still he's a sort of unique, isn't he, given that there's a lot of pressure from the 9/11 Commission report to create some kind of uber intelligence czar that has more budget authority. I mean, the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, which is what Tenet's job was and what Goss's job would be, ostensibly is the Director of Central Intelligence, but we all know that that is in name only. So what kind of a job is he going to have?
Well, I agree with you. I think he's going to be a lame duck, institutional lame duck, a bureaucratic lame duck, and a political lame duck, because if they move to some kind of national intelligence director, and probably czar suggests a more powerful role than the Bush administration will agree to, then Portergos will not have much of a position. But the real problem here is that the military controls the intelligence community. We have an intelligence budget of about, it's over $40 billion. We pay more for intelligence than the entire world pays combined. And the Pentagon controls about 85% of that budget and 90% of the personnel. So until you have a plan to wrestle control from the Pentagon, and particularly from Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, who's been one of the most powerful Secretaries of Defense in American history, certainly since the position was created in 1947, I don't think there's going to be any real reform. The other reform wouldn't cost the United States anything, and it's about time for the CIA to tell truth to power. The CIA can't be rolled by one political administration after another. They were rolled under Bill Casey and Bob Gates in the 1980s when they gave the Reagan administration false intelligence on the Soviet Union to justify the Reagan defense budgets. And then they were rolled by George W. Bush in 2002 and 2003, so Bush could take on a war that I think he was committed to when he came into office in 2001. And that's the real reform that has to take place, a little bit of honesty on the part of the CIA, a little bit of professionalism and restoration of a moral compass. This is what I find so unconscionable.
Well, let's try and give the public an idea, though, of how budgetary authority really is where the game is at, and why it is that we have a director of Central Intelligence who basically doesn't control Central Intelligence, even though that was the notion of the 1947 Act. A good example is the cancellation of the SR-71, the Blackbird program. You recall that that plane that could fly very high and very fast, and you could order that plane up, and it would take specific reconnaissance pictures of you know, fairly quickly, and for, you know, ordered up for by tactical command. So I recall just before the first Gulf War that, you know, because the satellites go around the Earth and it takes a while to position them, and you don't get a constant stream, whereas if you have an SR-71, you can literally order it to fly over a certain area. And just before the first Gulf War, they suddenly found out that they didn't have the Blackbird anymore, because the Air Force hated the fact that they flew this expensive program, but the take went to the CIA. So is that an example of this?
That's an example of the problem, but I think I would go back and compare it to the U-2, which was the predecessor to the Blackbird. That was developed at a time when the CIA had the science background, the technological background, to develop an overhead reconnaissance plane and actually monitor the plane and implement the program. The CIA doesn't even have these capabilities anymore. I think what people don't really understand, including players in the House and the Senate, is how much derogation of capability you've had at the CIA over the past 30 or 40 years. So they're no longer in a position to do the science and technology work that leads to the development of a aircraft such as the U-2 or the Blackbird or now the Predator. I think the real budgetary problem here, and this could be corrected very easily. Right now, the intelligence community budget of $40 billion is a secret budget. That $40 billion figure is considered a classified secret on the part of the U.S. government, and the CIA budget of about $4 billion a year is also considered a classified number. I think the intelligence budget should be a separate line item in the budget, not hidden within the Pentagon's budget, which is the way it is now, and this should be debated politically. But the Central Intelligence Agency has fought this over the years, therefore it gives the Pentagon direct control over the budget because it's hidden within the Pentagon budget, and they have a lot to say about the major combat support agencies in the intelligence community, which are the largest agencies, much larger than the CIA in terms of personnel and budgetary authority, the National Security Agency, the National Reconnaissance Office, the National Geospatial Agency, which interprets satellite photography. So not only do you have this power within a policymaking institution like the Pentagon, you have the Pentagon given complete budgetary authority over the intelligence community budget except for that of the CIA. So this is the correction that needs to take place, and this has not been part of the debate for some reason, because the Pentagon has a lot of players up on the Hill in the Senate Armed Forces Committee that protect the interests of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Until we tackle this problem, I don't see any real chance for reform.
David McMichael, what
is... There is one more element to this, Ian and Mel, is that going back to the post-Iran-Contra run-up to Gulf War debates, and at that time, if you go back, and Mel, you well remember this as the prime player in the Robert Gates confirmation hearing, the large amount of discussion of a really huge, first of all, intelligence scandal involving Casey and company over Iran-Contra, and then the dismal performance of U.S. intelligence overall at the time of Kuwait and the first Gulf War. The pressure that went on George Bush the first then to admit to more oversight, and you will recall particularly around the issue of so-called covert operations a more direct congressional role for the oversight. Bush, at the first Bush at that time, in attempting to escape that, kept insisting that when any of these activities were carried out by the United States Armed Forces or the Department of Defense, this came directly under his quote-unquote constitutional role as commander-in-chief and was not subject to any form of oversight. And this gave great impetus to moving more of these activities over into the Pentagon. I know very recently, for example, another 40,000 troops are going to be assigned to SOCOM, the Special Operations Command, down in MacDill. Is another example.
That's what Bush is going to announce tomorrow, Monday. The restructuring of the U.S. military. I think he's finally going to admit that the Cold War is over, that we don't need these vast armies in Germany and Korea.
Yeah, but the sad thing about this, and this relates to your previous segment with Professor Cole, is this is really being forced on us by Iraq. Iraq is becoming a cauldron now, which is sucking in all of America's active duty strength, and now our reserve strength, and even our National Guard strength. So we can't keep the forces in Europe and Asia. And maybe this is a Cold War problem, but I'd like to see these decisions being made in a strategic fashion, and not because of Iraq, because Iraq is now the tail that's wagging the Pentagon's dog on an international basis. This is not good for U.S. interests.
Well, it's also, I mean, it's clearly also an election year ploy as well. But let's just touch on two subjects. I mean, we are all aware of the intelligence failures prior to 9/11 and the lack of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the justification for the war. But it seems to me that back in the Cold War, the CIA missed one of the biggest programs of all, which was the secret Soviet biowarfare program that was vast, 100,000-plus employees, 60 facilities, right under our noses. And it only came out because a defector finally got over here and told the CIA the full extent of how not only had the Russians been in violation of the Biological Warfare Convention since its inception, they were actually had weaponized tons and tons of anthrax and other nasty things, and they'd put them on their SS-18 warheads aimed at American cities, et cetera, et cetera. It's a huge thing. Now, I understand, having spoken to the main Soviet defector who brought the news, he was the deputy director of this secret program in the Soviet Union. Apparently, our side were only focused on toxins, not on bio. And Porter Goss, I believe, was involved with that program. In fact, he got poisoned and had to leave the CIA. So, to me, there's another story here of how all this money doesn't guarantee you. There's an old expression that intelligence is no guarantee against stupidity.
Well, I don't know if I agree with all of the statements you've just put forward. In fact, some of them are misstatements.
Okay, well, correct me then.
There's no intelligence whatsoever that the Soviets had put biological warheads on their SS-18s. And frankly, that would be a misuse of a strategic weapon. I don't know why they would do anything so strategically stupid.
Well,
Goss was involved in these biological weapons programs, and that led to the kidney infection that forced him to leave the CIA. And the Soviet defector, and I'm aware of his work, has produced a lot of misinformation. The fact of the matter is that if you look at the CIA's record over a period of 40 years, the worst years of the Cold War, the Soviet Union never introduced a weapon system to its inventory that the CIA didn't have advance information about. I think we have to realize when we're critics of the CIA that the CIA did some very good work over the years in terms of real intelligence value that enabled arms control agreements such as SALT and INF and the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. And I think all of this turned on the ability to verify and to monitor Soviet weapons programs. So there were no strategic surprises in terms of the Soviet inventory. What politicians did every 4 years, particularly during an election campaign, was to overstate the capabilities of the Soviet Union. And that's why you had false claims of a missile gap and a bomber gap and a intentions gap that Reagan exploited with the American people using a professor from Harvard, Richard Pipes. And it took someone like President Eisenhower to argue down the whole notion of a bomber gap. And then you had someone such as President Kennedy, who had the false charges about a so-called missile gap in the early 1960s. So I would be very careful with that kind of information, because the overall record of the CIA was quite good, and it was better than the record of any other intelligence agency or policy agency in that period of time.
So we didn't miss the vast bio. I mean, after the Sverdlovsk incident, which is in 79.
Well, I remember I was at the CIA at that time, and I remember debating that. And there were great amounts of information that were produced to show that the Sverdlovsk leaking had a lot to do with biological weapons. And this led directly to the biological weapons treaty that President Nixon signed in the early 1970s. And it's kind of interesting that Nixon realized that he couldn't be confident that the Americans would destroy all of their biological weapons. And frankly, it took us 20 years to destroy all of our biological weapons stocks and live up to a treaty that was signed in 1971. So this is a much more convoluted and complex story than it appears to be at face value.
Well, let's just close then on a final question. I'll ask David McNichol. Is there a civil war going on there inside the Beltway? Because it seems to me that the people that brought us the Committee on the Present Danger that helped elect Reagan are pretty much the same people that are labeled the neocons today. And it seems that, having recently interviewed Anonymous, who's still inside the CIA, you get the impression that the agency is sort of fighting back against this shop that Wolfowitz and Feith set up over in the Pentagon. And am I exaggerating the idea that there's a kind of civil war going on inside the Beltway?
Well, I don't know if civil war is the correct term, but there's certainly a very intense debate and struggle. And, of course, that comes down to something which is really outside the area of intelligence, at least as I understand it, and that is the formation of goals and policies and decisions on means to carry them out. Now, these things do not necessarily depend upon a close and accurate definition of possible opponents' capabilities and intentions. But there's certainly no doubt, and I don't think Mel will disagree with me here, that at various times, ideology translated into political programs drives the intelligence effort, despite the best efforts of good analysts and committed people to try to speak truth to power. It's a hard thing to do.
Well, just in closing, Mel Goodman, what do you think in terms of these battle lines? I mean, it seems to me isn't Charlie an example of this? I mean, I don't understand why Wolfowitz and Feith haven't been forced to go public and explain Charlie's actions.
Well, they shouldn't be forced to go public. They should have been fired. I mean, the CIA was quite correct in issuing secret warnings to the entire policy community that this man is a fabricator. He cannot be trusted. He's failed lie detector tests. Don't do business with him. But it was clear that Wolfowitz and Feith wanted to go to war against Iraq, and Chalabi gave him the kind of material that was needed to support this war. But be very careful with the notion of a civil war within the Beltway. I was involved in the CIA over the strategic arms limitations talks of the 1960s and early 1970s, and there you had very courageous CIA officials who did what David McMichael is saying that's so important, telling truth to power. Here in the 2002-2003 run-up to the war in Iraq, there were very few examples of CIA officials willing to stick their neck out and tell truth to power. And one final warning, since I know Anonymous and I know his work and I know what he believes, be very careful in taking everything he says at face value, because when you talk to Anonymous, and believe me, he has very little background in military affairs, he's someone who believes that all the Islamic problem needs is more force, that if you apply more military power against the problem, you will eventually defeat the problem of terrorism. And he would put us in the same situation that a series of Israeli leaders have put Israel in when they have no answer for Palestinian positions and Palestinian stakes than to apply nothing but military force to the Palestinian problem. And that's why Israel has a strategic problem on its hands now that it's going to have a great time, a very difficult time dealing with over the years. Military force alone is simply not the answer. The overall answer to terrorism for this country is better intelligence and better law enforcement and very painstaking liaison work with our allies. To think that we can invade a country such as Iraq, which only produces more terrorism, and that somehow the problem will go away is really misguided. And that's why this country is in the national security morass that it's in right now.
Well, but just in closing, I mean, here's Anonymous inside the agency essentially repudiating his commander-in-chief, talking about imperial hubris and that we're losing the war and that Bush is going about it in the wrong way. Does that indicate that the intelligence professionals and the uniformed military have lost respect, faith, and confidence in their commander-in-chief?
No. Again, I know Anonymous, and believe me, he stands alone. This guy is a maverick. I'm not saying I don't have a certain amount of respect for his positions, and frankly, his first book was a lot more interesting than his second book because he did a very good work on the writings and the philosophy of Osama bin Laden, because his own colleagues within the CIA did not take Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and bin Laden very seriously and looked on bin Laden as nothing other than a money bag for the al-Qaeda organization. So I think the work that Anonymous is doing, it reflects more his frustration at dealing with his own colleagues than it does dealing with the Bush administration and the neoconservatives who dominate the Pentagon. I'm not saying there isn't a real problem out there in terms of policy, but I'd be very careful with some of the worst-case analysts, such as Charlie Allen at the CIA or Anonymous at the CIA, or even some of the things that Richard Clark has written over the years, even though generally I'm a supporter of his book, Against All Enemies. He's another one who believes that military power is the only answer to this terrorist problem. It's going to be a much more difficult battle than that, and I hope the United States understands what it's doing. The fact that we've committed half of our active duty forces to Iraq suggests we don't have a clue to what we're doing.
I thank both David McMichael and Mel Goodman, former CIA analysts, both for joining us here. And thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And David, we have to stop meeting like this.
Bye-bye. And I was just speaking there with David McMichael, a former analyst at the CIA, and Mel Goodman, also a former analyst at the CIA. And I'm now speaking with Ian Williams, who's a veteran journalist and the Nation's UN correspondent and the author of a new book, Deserter, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. So why is this fellow who has such a shoddy, albeit shredded record in the Alabama and Texas Air National Guard, why do so many people in this country consider him a steward of national security, and why are they dubious of a true war veteran who actually fought in Vietnam as opposed to avoiding Vietnam like Cheney and Bush did, why, and Clinton too? Why this disconnect?
It's strange stuff, really. We're talking about theology more than rationality. It's an act of faith. There are lots of people there who will not accept Kerry as a war veteran because he came back and opposed the war in Vietnam. So no matter what he did beforehand, he is not the real thing as far as they're concerned.
Well, that's the motive, by the way. Isn't that the motive of this Admiral Huffman, who's still mad at Kerry because he when he got back from Vietnam, he questioned the military efficacy of the entire Swift Boat program?
I think he was also suggesting that people like Admiral Hoffman were going up and killing civilians at random, which is ironic because that's one of the things they're now accused. They're almost trying to accuse Kerry of war crimes, when earlier they were complaining that he'd said the U.S. military was carrying out war crimes in Vietnam.
Well, they already, 60 Minutes already absolutely ruined the other Kerry, Bob Kerry, didn't they? They ambushed him on television,
well,
accusing him of...
Well, he basically fessed up to it, and that's the whole... I mean, the war was an evil, vicious thing, and Kerry saw so and came back and protested. These other people came back, and they have never forgiven people like Kerry for showing them up, and... Yeah, I think somewhere on the liberals on the left side, we also have to answer for this because we all remember who Lieutenant Kelly was, or most of us remember who Lieutenant Kelly was, the guy who was found guilty and given a sort of rap on the knuckles for the My Lai massacre. But we should have actually had a poster boy in our on our dorm and the walls of Warrant Officer Hugh Thompson. He was the guy. He was the helicopter pilot who landed with his gunner and threatened to shoot American troops if they carried on massacring at My Lai. Now, this guy is a real hero, and he shows that the military could produce heroes. Of course, you know, the Swift Boat veterans probably don't like him very much either, since he actually stopped a war crime happening and gave evidence afterwards. But that's what I'm saying about this being a theological thing. Bush, as far as they're concerned, can do no wrong because he's on their side, full stop. The facts of it will not disturb people like this. What we are aiming at, really, is the middle ground there who are looking at this. And I think Senator John McCain produced it a very almost, you might say, British comment when he was asked about the attack ads on Kerry. He said, well, you know, the Bush campaign, first of all, should condemn these unreservedly. And secondly, he said that John Kerry served honorably in Vietnam and President Bush served honorably in the Texas Air National Guard during the Vietnam War. I thought that was a brilliant put-down. But the problem is it's far too subtle for George W. Bush and his supporters, you know. These are the people who think that irony is what they used to make in the Rust Belt. They really need pinning down to be told that every time they raise this issue, they're building the potential for the people in the Kerry camp say, well, yes, thank you for testifying that Kerry was actually in this war he disagreed with. Now please produce your veterans that will show George W. Bush was there.
Well, I mean, I understand the theological nature of this, it's obviously clear that all of these so-called Swift Boat veterans for truth, if they were upset about Kerry's medals at the time, many of them actually, including the admiral, actually wrote the commendations. They should have challenged these back in the 60s. They clearly didn't. So
I think we're seeing a case of recovered memory syndrome.
So
I mean, the commander that's now disavowing them says that he just saw a scratch on the forearm. Well, the medical reports show that the wound, the piece of shrapnel, no matter how deep or otherwise, was actually in his upper arm above the elbow. So already we have him down on a false memory that nobody else bothered to check up. And that's really the thing. I mean, without being too partisan about Kerry, is people are making, journalists are reporting these accusations without doing the elementary fact-checking that would show that these people are not remembering things the way that the documentation shows that they were.
Well, you know, what more do you need? You've got the actual Special Forces guy that Kerry pulled out of the river who tells it his version, you know, and says these guys weren't even around. So it reminds me of the...
But it was interesting, if I can interpolate on to how the other side thinks here. I was on the O'Reilly Factor the other night, and he was on the segment just before me, the Green Beret, and O'Reilly said, oh, well, of course, we have to listen to you because you are a veteran and a registered Republican.
Right, this is Rasmussen.
Which is really interesting, sort of almost post-Islamic view that some witnesses are worth more than others.
But this whole episode, and going back to how McCain was slimed by Bush and his surrogates in South Carolina, it reminds me of the famous statement that finally was the undoing of Joe McCarthy's reckless, outrageous behavior, where Welch said, "Have you no shame?" I mean, why isn't somebody saying, "Have you no shame?"
Well, that's what I've been telling people. I've been invoking that, and the answer is, of course, they could say it to Joseph McCarthy and bring him down. But if you go to Karl Rove and Scott McClellan and George W. Bush and say, "Have you no shame?" they would look at you, grin, and say, no, none at all. Let's carry on, you know, and they get away with it. They get away with it.
Because it works.
Yes.
So what's wrong with the Kerry side then? Well, I mean, this is the one asset that he's been selling, his military record, and here they are sowing confusion and trying to undo the truth.
I think he's allowed himself to be maneuvered into the wrong field of battle. In a sense, he's walked into an ambush. It was necessary. The Bush was projecting himself as the war commander in the War on Terror, and this was the one thing that people remembered his alleged leadership after September the 11th, and this was an asset, and so Kerry had to counter that, and he sort of made the battlefield. He produced all of these people testifying to his war record, but they shouldn't have been talking about his war record. We've got to remember, for a huge number of voters, Vietnam is ancient history. It's like sort of the 60s. It's like sort of whether someone was a conscientious objector or not in the First World War for many voters. But once you get into it, somehow, even though it was sort of Kennedy and LBJ who sort of really prosecuted this war, and it was Richard Nixon who eventually finished it, the Vietnam War has become Republican-occupied territory. And Kerry is not disputing it. This is the fascinating bit. Nobody's arguing about whether it was good to go to a faraway land, kill 50,000 of our own people killed, and to kill several million Vietnamese. That's not the question at issue. It's a question of this sort of integrity thing of what people did or didn't do at the time. And whatever you do, unless you actually confront this, you're bound to be wrong, because if you get and say, I volunteered to go there because I like killing gooks, then you're going to alienate a fair number of liberal voters. If you turn around and say that I went there because I was serving my country, and right or wrong, then you might well sort of get some conservative votes lined up. But Kerry's got himself in this position, and I really think that he should be making comparisons. This bozo in the White House actually skipped the last war he started. He supported. He supported the Vietnam War throughout. He canvassed for candidates who supported the Vietnam War, and he dodged it. Now he started another war, and he's dodging that one as well. He's sending people to die. And Iraqi civilians and American GIs are dying because this guy, once again, is leading us into a Vietnam lookalike. Now, you know, I think that would be a little more explicit and put the debate on, sort of throw the smoking bomb back into the Bush court.
Well, let's just finish on a question then. Given that this Iraq war looks like Vietnam at warp speed, why is it that the American people don't know that we've already lost this war? We lost it a long time ago. And how come Kerry can't get this message across? Because I think if the American people knew what a disaster Bush has put us in, they'd boot him out.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Kerry isn't fighting on this one. Kerry's hedging again. He did vote for the War Powers Act, and he's explained it, and it makes some sense, but I wouldn't buy it. He could actually get up and say, well, I was wrong. I was misled by the president because he told us he had information. But he's sort of put himself on the defensive. He's not saying that the war is wrong because he thinks that would alienate the same constituents he's going after. And, you know, I really think the battleground here, which I think Bush perhaps realizes more than Kerry, we're not talking about the actual serving military, because the evidence suggests that they mostly vote Democrat. You know, they're 42% minorities.
Right.
A black GI from Florida is not going to vote for Jeb Bush.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Ian Williams. I thank you very much for joining us here.
Okay, thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking with Ian Williams, who's the Nation's UN correspondent and the author of a new book, Deserter, George W. Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Louis Vandenberg, the producer, and Grant Gruber and Carol Kuth, the assistant producers. This program and all previous programs can be accessed at ianmasters.org. That's ianmasters.org.